The U.S. Supreme Court is set to further clarify its views on religion in America. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, March 25th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Mike Thompson joins us for a look at cases headed to the nation's highest court. The court has been trending towards protection of mainstream Christian organizations. This April might pave the way for more of that. We'll discuss Catholic charities. We'll explore the potential creation of the first state-funded religious charter school. And we'll ask what rights parents have when they don't like a book that's about to be read to their kids in the classroom. Plus, Teacher Talk goes beyond self-care to ask how to create space for collective care. We ask what to do when teaching takes a toll later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This month and next, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear three cases about the religious clause of the First Amendment. And a fourth case could be on its way to the court, and that one would have support of the South Dakota legislature behind it. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He's our go-to expert on the U.S. Supreme Court. He stopped by SDPB's Kirby Family Studio to unpack the arguments and implications of these upcoming cases.
There's got to be at least one person out there who has pulled out their Constitution.
Yes.
And got the First Amendment right there.
Yep.
Because the First Amendment, at least the religion clauses, say Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And so I know that astute listener is going to say, well, these are state cases.
Yeah.
This isn't Congress. And that's a valid point. But the Supreme Court, since the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868 with its due process clause, the court has taken piece by piece all the Bill of Rights protections and applied those to the states through the 14th.
Okay.
So the First Amendment, I can put that to rest. The First Amendment applies to everybody.
Okay.
Equally.
Okay.
And a couple of other historical things. Of course, we know that Madison and James Madison and Thomas Jefferson were fans of this wall of separation between church and state.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, as presidents and as in other positions, they allowed religion to come into the governmental sphere, which is relevant to the way the Supreme Court is starting to look at the religion clauses.
Hmm.
So we've got an establishment clause and we have a free exercise clause. In 1971, the court, in a case called Lemon versus Kurtzman, set up a three-step analysis to determine whether the establishment clause had been violated. They used that three-factor analysis up until 2022. So all these establishment claims, the court would always use the Lemon test.
And when was that from, the Lemon test?
Lemon versus Kurtzman, 1971.
Okay.
And in fact, it was the Lemon test was used by the Supreme Court to say that the posting of the Ten Commandments in a school violated the Establishment Clause. There's a Supreme Court case directly on point that says no Ten Commandments in the school. But the thing that has changed this is in the Bremerton case. That was where the football coach was mm-hmm. praying at midfield, and the school didn't want him to do that because they thought he was establishing a religion, so they fired him, which turned out to be, via the Supreme Court's ruling, a violation of his free exercise rights and his free speech rights.
Mm.
But anyway, in that case, the court said we're done with the Lemon test. Done with the Lemon test. We're going to go back to and look at what the position of the claim was around the time of the founding. How much of religion was allowed into the public arena? How much wasn't? What was acceptable? What isn't? So the court has kind of gone into what they do with the Second Amendment to try to figure out what was going on at the time of the founding. So
in the courts, or just, you said earlier, like, these presidents allowed it into the public. So what, like, presidential history?
Yeah, presidential history, okay. Their writings,
okay.
What the states were doing at the time, what they allowed, what they didn't allow,
sure.
To see sort of how much mix there was at that time of the drafting of the First Amendment to try to determine the reach of these two clauses.
Oh, interesting. So looking at the intent.
Yep, trying to determine intent.
And you run into the same problems that you do with the Second Amendment, which was they couldn't possibly imagine the kind of weaponry that's available to the citizenry today.
Right.
Likewise, they couldn't possibly have imagined social media and, you know, the world that we live in today. Yeah.
Virtual charter schools.
Yeah.
That wasn't part. As far as I know, I'm no historian, but that wasn't part of.
But not for nothing. They're so okay. So how can they possibly look back to then and say it applies?
Right.
So how do you look back at something from the founding days and say it applies to us today when so much has changed? I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I think they look at it more broadly. So in some of these cases, they reference a letter or reference some actions that Madison actually took as president, where celebrating a religious holiday and tying the government to religion that way. So then the courts say, well, wait a minute, it's not an absolute wall. It's not an absolute line. There is some.
It never has been.
Blurring, right. It never has been. So we got to figure out how much essentially we're going to allow the two things to come together. These new cases, so Bremerton's a 2022 case, Carson versus Macon, a 2022 case. So we're getting all these new cases to test this court's new approach to determining what's an Establishment Clause problem and what's a free exercise problem. After Lemon's gone, now all these cases that were decided using that Lemon framework are coming back.
Okay. So if your knowledge is from the 80s, the 90s, the 70s, there's a reason the world feels topsy-turvy to you right now.
Right.
We're looking at it from a different lens than perhaps you have become used to looking at it.
Yeah, if you followed the Establishment Clause for a long time, this is a crazy time for you.
All right.
So Carson versus Macon, where Maine allowed public funding to secondary students who had to attend a school outside of their locale, a certain area. And so the state said, we're not going to give that public money to students who want to attend a religious school, a school based on religion or funded by religion, whatever. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. If you have a generally available benefit, you cannot deny that based on religion, essentially. It's generally available. You can't deny it based on religion. The first one, and then there's a case called Trinity Lutheran, which is, I smile, nobody sees it, but it's kind of, the government allowed funding for rubber-padded playground equipment. Pieces of old tires that you could put on the ground in a playground.
Okay.
And so public schools were able to get this funding to modernize their playgrounds, but religious schools were not. So the Supreme Court said, can't do that either. It's an otherwise available fund. You can't deny it to a religious organization.
Right.
So that gets us into...
that reminds me of the Sioux Falls snowplow debate.
Yes,
when they said,
you
can paint the plow. And then the religious schools painted religious messages on the plow. And then all of a sudden you had religious messages on a piece of city property. And then the question was, is that allowed?
Right.
And the answer was, if the kids can paint the plow, they get to decide what they're going to paint on it.
Right.
And here come the Christian school plows.
Right.
Yeah.
And if Lemon was around then, Lemon would say that's not too much of an entanglement constitute an establishment problem. So the first one, we've Catholic Charities versus the Wisconsin Labor Review Committee. That one is set for argument on March 31st. And that one involves Catholic Charities, obviously, which is run by the Catholic Diocese. And there's the state of Wisconsin has an exemption from the payment of unemployment tax given to institutions with a religious purpose.
Okay.
So the Catholic Charities want the exemption. Wisconsin, the review committee, the administrative agency, denied the exemption because they weren't acting with a religious purpose. It's Catholic Charities' burden. Yes, they're controlled by the Catholic Church, but the actual Charities Bureau did not function with a religious purpose.
They weren't bringing out religious messages. They right. were just, they're not saying here the Catholics are going to preach to you and then feed you. They're just feeding you.
Right.
And they said, well, we're feeding you because we're Catholic.
Right, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Said, no, it's not for a religious purpose at all.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main problems with the case, the main problems for Wisconsin in the case is there's an old 1940s case called Cantwell versus Connecticut. And in that case, there were some Jehovah's Witnesses who were going door to door in a Catholic neighborhood, and they were playing, handing out stuff, playing records that talked down the Catholic Church. And they were arrested for doing that because they didn't have a permit. They
okay.
had to go to this one governmental official who would determine by himself or herself whether what they were doing was religious. And the Supreme Court said, you cannot do that. You cannot have the government declaring what is or is not a religious purpose. So here you have the
okay.
court, the Wisconsin yeah. court, who is saying, okay, we're going to analyze what the Catholic Church believes and what the charities are doing, and we don't think they're acting with a religious purpose either. Therefore, they got to pay into the state unemployment tax fund.
Mm-hmm.
So the question in that case is...
Not for the diocese, but for the charities.
Right, for the
yeah.
charities. The question is whether, again, we've got this otherwise available governmental benefit,
mm-hmm.
and you deny it to a church, which, according to Macon and Trinity Lutheran, that's a no-no. And then plus you've got, James Madison said that a magistrate is the last person who should be deciding what a religious purpose is.
Oh, okay.
So it's pretty clear that the court is out there somewhere. I guess I should be more respectful. That the court looks like it's misapplying some precedents. So
why do you think the Supreme Court takes this case?
I think they want to make it clear that what they said in Macon and Trinity Lutheran, and there's another case called Espinoza, they all deal with the same issue, this otherwise available or generally available benefit. They say they want to make sure that these lower courts know we're not just messing around with this. This is mm-hmm. the law now, and you need to follow it. And I think they're going to talk about the fact that you had that these judges went in and decided this. These judges actually decided whether there was a religious purpose. And in their defense, the statute probably...
The judges
probably,
in Wisconsin.
Yeah, the judges yeah. in Wisconsin.
Okay.
In their defense, the statute, that's what the statutory language is. And, of course,
yeah.
they're interpreting the statutory language.
Yeah, but James Madison said...
James Madison said, no,
you're not the one.
Yeah, you're okay. you're not the one.
You don't get to decide
no,
that.
No, you don't
All right.
get to.
So that will be interesting. What's the impact on workers?
Well, if they... If,
yeah, if you work for those charities, I'm thinking of Hobby Lobby, and just like if you work for somebody, and then they can make decisions based on their, right?
On their religion?
On their religion, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bringing up Hobby Lobby, these are all, what we're talking about today are all court cases based on the Constitution, the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government during Clinton's administration passed a couple of statutes that deal with religion, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and
okay.
the religion, it's a long one, Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act
oh.
that also deal with exercise, free exercise and establishment. So none of these cases are based on that statute, but Hobby Lobby versus Burwell that dealt with the ACA's command that as part of your health plan, you got to provide contraceptives. That was not decided based on the First Amendment. It was decided based on those statutes.
Okay.
So, which is
sure.
a different.
Okay. That's helpful.
Different standard. I hope it's helpful
it
because
is.
It's so darn fun to talk about.
All right, so that one we'll hear arguments on March 31st.
March 31st,
but they're scheduled to. What are you listening for in those arguments?
I'm listening for especially the Gorsuch crew and Justice Thomas to just see how angry they are that this keeps happening.
Yeah.
That this keeps happening in the lower courts after they've been really clear that here's the rule. And
right.
In one of these, the Oklahoma Charter School case that we'll get to, the Supreme Court, you can just smell their anger in how they've posed the question in the case.
Let's talk about Mahmoud v. Taylor, the Montgomery County Board of Education.
And that's going to be
our... This is about books.
It's about books.
Teacher can read to you kids in school.
Yeah, that's right. This is about what can... Well, this is about what can be read. This one's going to be argued on April 22nd of 2025.
Okay.
And so for those of you who hang on by a thread on these arguments, the court's last argument day is April 30.
Oh, okay.
2025, so we're rapidly approaching the sad end of...
And then we get to wait for decisions.
Then we get to
And
wait.
Then we get to have you
Then
back.
We get to talk about
yes,
those.
Yes, exactly.
So, Mahmoud versus Taylor. This is they're all interesting cases, but this is an interesting case from a procedural standpoint, too. So, this school adopted books that talked about pride parades, same-sex playground romances. There was one called Pride Puppy, that about a puppy who gets lost during a pride parade. And the books stress cis normativity. So they're trying to educate children from kindergarten through fifth grade, open their minds essentially to the acceptance of different sexual orientations, I guess. So the teachers have to read these books to whatever age of student it's appropriate for, according to the school board. Initially, the board said, okay, parents, we'll let you know when the books are going to be read, and you can opt your child out if you don't want the child to listen to the message. Later, pretty quickly, actually, the board changed its mind and said, we're not going to let you know when they're going to be read, and you can't opt out, so your kid's got to sit there and listen. There was a lawsuit brought by a number of people from different faiths saying this burdens our free exercise. Our children, they have to sit there. They are compelled to sit there and listen to a message that might be contrary to their religious beliefs. And the parents aren't attacking the curriculum. They're not saying that these books shouldn't be read or that children should not be exposed to them. They're just saying, that does what those books are saying does not follow our religious tenets.
Okay.
So we don't want our kid in there.
Right. And you need to notify me so that I can make a decision about whether my child will hear that day. And you're not willing to do that. So I'm going to sue.
Right.
Okay.
So the plaintiffs sue and they ask for an injunction, which is the court order stopping the reading of the books. The district court, the federal district court, said, you haven't shown a burden. Yeah, you haven't shown how this burdens your free exercise. They appeal. The Fourth Circuit, federal Fourth Circuit, agrees with the district court and says, you can't show a burden. You can't show how this burdens your free exercise to have your child.
You still get to practice your religion. This isn't changing that.
Right.
We're not telling you have to believe this. We're just telling you have to sit and listen to a book.
Right.
Go
right.
home and talk to your kid about it.
Yep. Yep, yeah, exactly.
That's what they're arguing.
Exactly.
Okay.
So both those federal courts said, no, you haven't shown a burden. It's one of the things you have to show to be eligible for an injunction, so we're going to deny the injunction. And then the Supreme Court takes it, which is curious because at the injunction stage, there's been very little evidence produced.
Okay.
We have no evidence on actual burden. It's a very small record of activity. If the Supreme Court wasn't that interested in it yet, they could just not hear it. And there's no injunction, but the litigation continues. And after you've developed more evidence, then it might be time for another appeal. But the court took it at this injunction stage, which is, I think, pretty rare. And the question they're going to decide is whether that is a burden, whether having the child there is a burden. Now, in free exercise in establishment cases, the C word is very important, coercion or compulsion. If the government activity compels you to do something that doesn't square with your religious beliefs, that is enough for a free exercise claim. So this is compulsion.
Yeah.
You've got a captive audience.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to look at, okay, under this situation, is this enough compulsion to amount to a burden on the free exercise?
Okay.
And so if they say, yeah, this is enough of a burden, then it's going to go back. We'll probably have an injunction.
But it's not a good sign for the parents in this case that the Supreme Court has said, yeah, we want to hear that.
I think it is a good sign for the parents.
Oh, you think it's a good sign for the parents?
Because,
oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry. I got twisted. Right. Yep. It's a good sign for the parents. It's not a good sign for the school district.
That's what I think.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't know why the school district changed their mind about the opt-out. I think it had something to do with absenteeism. They were afraid there'd be a bunch
Nobody's going to come to school.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's, I think the Supreme Court taking the case at this stage in the litigation is a message that they're going to find this to be a burden. The compelled attendance is going to be a burden.
Right, yeah. And you have to sit there for it.
Yeah. I got to sit here and listen to
and
stuff.
And a kindergartner, you know, like a high school student might get up and walk out.
Yeah.
But a kindergartner is going to sit there and listen to a book about a puppy.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'd sit there and listen to a book about a puppy.
Did they find the puppy at the end of the fry
don't
break?
I haven't read the book.
I really want the puppy to be okay. But this, let's pause for a minute and go back to what you were saying about Madison and like how in the world do you look for, because in this day and age in America, there are religions that probably the founding fathers did not imagine existed.
I know.
And so especially when you look at the Palestinian and Israel conflict, anything about Judaism might be considered by somebody to be an infringement on their practice of religion,
right.
And vice versa.
It
might be
Islam.
Anti-Semitic if you have something about Palestinians in Gaza, and then someone might say that's not. So where on earth would you look in the past to find the thoughts of the founding fathers to predict how they might have thought about the world that we live in today?
I think that for that intent purpose, you're looking at religion as a belief in a higher power.
Okay.
It's a broad definition. So even though the founders might not have had Islam or Judaism in mind when they drafted the First Amendment, those are religions, so they would fit that overall broad definition of religion.
Mm-hmm. If you believe, your family believes in what, Jainism, you're offended by a book that's about meat eating or ag industry or, you know.
Yeah.
So it's, there's just a whole lot.
Yeah, there's.
What I'm saying is, like, it's tough for school districts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's and that argument about if I let him pray on the 50-yard line, I'm establishing a religion. That's a real argument, and that's been noted by the Supreme Court over and over and over again that these clauses are really in a fight with each other.
Yeah.
In many, many situations.
Yeah. And it's because some of the players really were saying to that coach, like, if I don't go over and participate in that, I'm not in the club. You know, I'm not the coach's inner circle so I have to pretty much go over there and pretend that I'm praying with the coach, whereas I'm not a Christian and I don't believe what he believes.
Right.
And so that was the battle.
And then you had your element of compulsion or them feeling compelled to participate.
Yeah.
That case, I got to say this too, but the case was also based on free speech apart from religion. So there is that part of it, but the court did reach the question of religious exercise.
So the point being, all these things interact and intersect and work with each other and sometimes at odds with each other.
Right. And I think
just like Americans.
Yes.
We all intersect, interact, and work with each other and against each other.
And we're darn good at
it. We're really good at it.
That's true.
All right. Let's talk about Oklahoma Charter School Board.
Okay.
Drummond.
So people out there who have an interest in this, the Supreme Court's website is fantastic because it has all the court orders. But so you can go on there and you can get the questions that are presented in these cases. And this one, I'm smiling because The court says this court has repeatedly held that a state violates the Free Exercise Clause when it excludes religious observers from otherwise available public benefits. Three times the court has applied that principle to strike down state efforts to withhold otherwise available public benefits from religious organizations. Mm-hmm. And then it says, contrary to these precedents, the Oklahoma Supreme Court. So you know where that's going. So they consolidated the Oklahoma Charter School with, there's another case, St. Isidore of Seville, and that's a school tied to the charter. The Oklahoma Supreme Court. Oklahoma has a clause in its constitution that says that no state money can be used for religious purposes. Mm-hmm. South Dakota's got the same provision. Lots of states have that provision, but nobody enforces it because depending on how you do it, you're going to violate the First Amendment. So the Oklahoma Supreme Court said our constitution prevents this. We cannot use public funds to finance a Catholic charter school. Oklahoma Constitution prohibits it. Well, the First Amendment may or may not. That's what's important. And then they try to say, so St. Isidore, which is the school, these are online charter schools, virtual schools. Mm-hmm. So St. Isidore enters into a contract with the state of Oklahoma. State of Oklahoma gives it money to function because the state of Oklahoma has the duty to provide a free education under its constitution. So, okay, we're going to contract with you, St. Isidore Catholic School, to provide this free education. The Oklahoma Supreme Court comes up with a pretty novel twist and says, okay, when you Oklahoma contract with a Catholic school, that makes the Catholic school the government. So when you contract like that, that makes you the government. Therefore, the government can't be a Catholic school.
Right.
Therefore, we're not going to fund you.
Yeah.
So it's pretty creative argument because the question, like at USF, for example, we're a private institution. We get money from the federal government in the form of financial aid. And the question is, does that make us the government? Because if it makes us the government, then we got the pesky Bill of Rights to be worried about. But if we're not the government, we don't. So, and the courts have said that that doesn't make us the government. But if the Sioux Falls Police shows up on our campus and we provide them access to a dorm room or we somehow assist them, we do become the government and we are subject to the criminal justice amendments. That is one of the questions the court says we're going to decide is whether this contract with St. Isidore makes St. Isidore the government. And you know that's going to be, of course, I don't know. You know that's going to be a loser. Mm. The Supreme Court's not going to say that because we've got this otherwise available benefit.
I guess my mind is in a little bit of a knot, and hopefully you can loosen it. But then why wouldn't all Catholic schools or religious schools in South Dakota just be free? Because this is the whole debate that we have is that it's, you know, we don't want public dollars going to private schools. And there was a fight over the education savings accounts this year in the State House. But if it's a publicly available benefit, then why is the state of South Dakota not funding all the private schools? What am I missing here? Something really obvious, it feels like.
I don't think it's something very obvious. I think some of those schools... I guess I don't know what benefits are available, monetary benefits are available to a public school. But if you've got benefits available to a public school in South Dakota that the state authorizes, I, as a religious institution, as a religious school, have the right to at least apply for those funds.
Okay.
There's another twist to that, too, because sometimes if a law has just an incidental impact on religious exercise, it doesn't violate the First Amendment. So these otherwise available funds, there might be other things, depending on how the qualifications are written, my qualification for that public money,
I feel like that's the answer to the question is down that hallway.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Someone's going to email me inthemoment@sdpb.org. Help me out with this one as my brain. Someone's like, no, it's really, it's very obvious.
But no, yeah, it's okay. Not obvious. It's yeah. Not obvious. So that one is just the way the court has put out publicly, here's what the question is. I think that's just telling you that.
Yeah. That and this would be the first publicly funded charter school in.
Yeah, publicly funded religious charter school.
Yeah, which seems unprecedented.
It is very unprecedented.
Okay.
It's very unprecedented. In this.
I guess what I'm saying is if it was that easy, why wasn't everybody doing it before?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Because they only started in 2022 and it took them that long.
Right. Yeah. 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 Because under Lemon, this doesn't.
This doesn't
survive. No way. No way that doesn't survive. That's way too much of an entanglement.
Okay.
But now under this new approach that we have, beginning with the Macon case.
How much do we know about the new approach? How settled is that? Not enough yet. Okay, so these are kind of the cases that that we will start hearing how they're thinking about this.
I think so.
Yeah, the fact that we don't know is not a surprise because this is fairly recent.
Right.
Makeup of this court.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
There is a Ten Commandments case that it did not pass in the South Dakota State House.
Right.
But there is one from Louisiana that's not been granted.
Right.
What are some of the arguments for and against having the Ten Commandments in the schools? Because when it was In God We Trust, there was the sense that, hey, that's on our money. That's sort of this passive, you know, way of talking about Thomas Jefferson, but et cetera, et cetera. And it passed, and really nobody has sued that I'm aware of in the state of South Dakota saying that infringed, on their faith or to walk by a picture of In God We Trust in the school.
Yeah,
and that's what they're arguing about the Ten Commandments.
Yeah,
but
such a part.
If you're teaching it, then we're back to.
If I'm teaching the Ten Commandments,
to the Mamet case.
Yep. Then it depends on how compelled it is, and who's objecting.
Right.
If anyone, and that Louisiana case, like I said in the beginning, there's a Supreme Court case that is from the Lemon era. It's exactly on point, saying you cannot put the Ten Commandments in a public school.
Right.
And so this is going to test that.
Test that under
the new standard, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to continue to be fun.
Mike Thompson teaches at the University of Sioux Falls. He is our go-to U.S. Supreme Court watcher, and he stopped by SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls for that conversation. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Self-care, you might already know, is important, but it has to be in conjunction with what's known as collective care. It's not only a matter of teacher well-being, but also student well-being. SDPB's Kara Hetland sat down with Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur to talk about the difference between self-care and collective care in education. That's this week's Teacher Talk conversation. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota School of Education. She began her career in public education in 2007, and she served as a middle and high school teacher and a public librarian. She is also an experienced registered yoga teacher through Yoga Alliance. Gina Benz is in her 25th year of teaching. She teaches Teacher Pathway and AP English Language at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. She's also on the adjunct faculty at several colleges and universities. She is the recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award. Here's their conversation.
I felt like I had to say something in response to our February 25th episode. That one was about compassionate classrooms, and Jackie was in charge of that, in charge of the content. And I was talking about how I have that critical voice in my head that's saying, you should be working on your to-do list, you should be working on your to-do list, when all I want to do is just sit for a little bit and watch a couple shows. But I should do that to-do list. And Jackie said, you should rest. Of course you're tired. Of course you should rest. You have three jobs. You're doing this and this and this. And nobody knew it, but I had that lump in my throat. I was about ready to cry. And it was because somebody saw me and because I knew she was right, that I do have a lot on my plate right now. So it led to a lot of self-reflection and how can I care for myself better?
And have you taken those steps to care for yourself better?
Yeah, I made a request at school to have my schedule changed for next year, and that should be a little bit of a lighter load. And I also made a commitment to myself that I'm only going to teach one night class a week. This year I've been doing two, so I'll do one night class a week.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, so I'm taking things off my plate, and it feels good.
And you're putting Gina first, or giving Gina time to have time?
You know, the two things I just mentioned are for next year, because I have commitments made, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can't just leave your students high and dry. Teachers don't, I mean, they can, I guess, but teachers typically always finish out their school year. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking to myself more compassionately, which is exactly what Jackie is a master at talking about and telling us about, that how about you use different words with yourself and say, hey, you have worked really hard. Just forget about the to-do list. Watch your show.
For now. I mean, the to-do list stays.
In moderation, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But, hey, 2 hours of TV to just escape for a little bit.
Do you ever put a to-do list together and say, this really doesn't have to be done till Thursday? This really doesn't have to be done until Friday? And then shift your to-do list?
I learned that from one of my mentor teachers, Jeff Lukens. It's a real skill to know what is urgent and what isn't. Mm-hmm. And also a skill of just taking care of the quick things to make that to-do list less overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So,
or cluster them by
I don't do that, but I like that. How, do you do that?
I do.
What does that look like?
Well, I can show you a calendar that I purchased that is very small on the dates and more on the projects. Mm-hmm. And so I'll say for this project that I'm working on, these are the things that I need to do this week. For this project, these are the things I need to do this week. And then I can decide which day or which hour I'm going to focus on those things, and then which can go, I can just slide them over into next week if it's really not urgent. Mm-hmm.
I like the idea because you're not switching back and forth between different tabs in your head, like on a computer screen. You're kind of in the same realm of thought.
It is a binder notebook that I control every week and control what projects I'm working on that week and what's the most important things and what I can just slide over to the next one. It's a cluster way.
I like that.
It's a project way. And if I have to send 5 emails, well, I can do all 5 right now. Mm-hmm. I'm going to look at all the things I get to cross off. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
So then, Jackie, what's yours? What's your big way to deal with a to-do list?
Oh, I mean, I think I've tried a lot of different methods, but I was just reflecting as I was listening to your method, Kara, that I had an AI tool that it then started costing money, so I don't use it anymore, but it was a similar concept where I would just enter everything I had to do as I was thinking of it. I could pop it in there. I could estimate about how much time that task would take me, and then I had the ability to mark if it had an actual hard deadline or if I wanted to get it done within the next week or the next month. And then it would populate my Outlook calendar and block off. Yeah, wow. It would block off times for me to say, like, you have this project that must be done by this time and it takes you 2 hours according to your estimation. And it would block off a section of time for me to do that. So I really liked that because it took the logistics of me carving out time and finding time. Like, I just had to put it in to the AI model, and it helped me organize it. But it sounds like your pen and paper method works very similarly, and I think that is helpful.
Yeah, and I really wanted to bring this up because all people who are in a profession of, you know, intensely caring for people, so it's not just teachers, but this is teacher talk, and so it is teachers as well. Sometimes we give and give and give at the expense of ourselves. We care so much about other people's well-being that we end up hurting or forgetting about our own well-being. And we can't do that because that leads to burnout, exhaustion. In the blog, I wrote all these words. It leads to bitterness, resentment, exhaustion, depression, anxiety, burnout, despair, headaches, indigestion, constipation, diarrhea, weight gain, and weight loss, to name a few.
Yeah.
And I've experienced, you know, headaches. I used to get a lot of headaches before I started to eliminate some grading that I did. Fewer assignments in my classroom, and among other things, helped me get rid of some headaches.
I think what I appreciate about this blog, Gina, and first of all, I didn't know that you had that response to our last conversation, so I always, it means a lot to me that you responded in that way, because I think, like many teachers, we don't always know how we come across, and so hearing that response is very helpful. But I think that one of the things that we can do as educators is change the way that we're talking to ourselves, because no one's going to do that for us. You know what I mean? Like, we have to change the way we're thinking about the work that we're doing in order to feel less stressed. Like, and so the fact that you gave yourself that affirmation of like, you know what, I really am doing a lot and I do need a minute to watch this show, makes it so that you can come back after however many shows you want to watch feeling a lot better. You know what I mean? But if the whole time you were watching the show, you were yelling at yourself about how you shouldn't be watching the show, that doesn't refresh you in any way, right? And so I think that is one area of control, at least for me, that I feel like I have in this profession of like, well, there's a lot of things I can't do anything about necessarily, or that the job just is what it is, but I can change the way I talk to myself. And if I need to watch a show, or I need to go for a walk, or if I need to take a deep breath, I need to respect my own boundaries, I guess, in that way, to make sure I get what I need.
I think the two of you come across as two people where teaching fills your cup, but teaching also drains your cup.
Right.
And then you have to find something else to fill it. Is that the wrong way to look at this?
I don't think so. Jackie, what do you think so?
No, not at all. I mean, I think many professions probably feel that way, but I think teaching is that, right? Like, we're in this because we're caregivers, we're invested in society, we care about the future, and that is an area of passion, but you have to take an in-breath with every out-breath. You know what I mean? You can't do, like you said, you have to fill your own cup in order to be able to keep giving.
Yeah, and I would say, how do I fill my own cup outside of the profession? Does this count?
Sure.
These weekly talks?
Sure.
Because I
not?
Love talking with Jackie, with Lori, with you, Kara. I love this. And so that fills my cup. But also, I like to write poetry. And go on walks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to know what cup filling mechanism you need in the moment, right?
Absolutely.
Sometimes I gotta read, and sometimes I don't want any light. I don't want any sounds. I just be quiet. And that's, you know, so it's just, you have to just, a lot of things can fill your cup. A lot of things can drain your cup.
Yeah.
But what does it take? And so then as a parent of a student, seeing a teacher, how do you help fill that teacher's cup? How do you help give them some kind of, be part of the collective care?
Yeah, because you don't have a teacher just yelling, empty! Fill my cup!
Right.
Well, how do parents see it? Jackie, jump in if you've got an idea. I'm thinking.
I think this is something we're working on as a society, right? Is just trying to see each other and show up for each other in ways that are helpful. I personally never felt, and don't in the role that I'm in now, that I need someone to necessarily do anything for me. But I think, how do I want to phrase this? I also think any acknowledgement of the work we do makes me feel so much more understood. You know what I mean? And I, one of the things I appreciate about this platform is that's one of the things we get back from it, is people say to me, oh, I heard you and Gina talking and it made me think about X, Y, or Z, and then I feel affirmed in this profession. So I do think parents can just simply be a good parent and show up for your child and take your kid to school and acknowledge that the teacher is doing their job. That, I think, goes a long way, you know. It's pretty, from my perspective anyway, it doesn't take a lot for me to feel filled up from a parent who just is doing their job as a parent and mm-hmm. acknowledging my job as a teacher.
Yeah, and really, you're right. It doesn't have to be anything fancy or gimmicky, just a word, mm-hmm. just a nice mm-hmm. word. It does so much.
Coming to parent-teacher conferences, saying hi when we see each other at the grocery store, you know, that kind mm-hmm. of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, doesn't have to cost money at all.
Making mm-hmm. sure your child is rested and has done their part is mm-hmm. a good thing, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So talk a little bit more about the collective care.
Okay, yeah.
And what that means and what, paint me that picture.
And this is a big transition that I needed to make in this blog, because it can't all be on me to take, you know, you can't just say, well, you're not taking care of yourself, that's why you're so stressed in this job. That's a part of it. But sometimes there are things within the job that maybe need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And some of these things are things we've done for decades upon decades, but maybe we need to reevaluate how we do things in the profession, in the structure of the school, to take care of all people in the school building. So collective care is the term I came across in my research. And the collective care could be so many things, and some are super difficult and complicated, but simple things. Like a lot of my research said, let's take away the extra duties that we assign to teachers beyond their teaching duties, right? So think about lunch duty, when teachers have to supervise the lunchroom. If we can take that away and let them instead have time to plan lessons, to give good, robust feedback on what their students' work is, that's just one thing we could do. Does it cost money? Yeah, because you maybe have to pay someone else to supervise the lunchroom, but I think that's money well spent.
For the teacher's self-care.
Because the research shows that teachers who feel happy and feel joy in life, they are better teachers. So it's for student learning. This is not just for the teachers. Mm.
That's SDPB's Kara Hetland talking with Jackie Wilbur and Gina Benz. You can find this episode and more on SDPB's Teacher Talk. It is a podcast that celebrates teachers and education. Find SDPB's Teacher Talk on your favorite podcast platform, and we put all the companion blogs with links to research on our website. That's at sdpb.org/teachertalk. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.